Welcome back, folks. Tuesdays at 11 o'clock, we always spend some time with folks that have contributed to the New Orleans Coalition and their initiatives in the city. These are difference makers each and every day, down in the trenches, working hard, coordinating with a lot of volunteers, raising dollars to backfill, to fund and finance so many different activities and critical activities, too. Because the assets and resources are not there as it relates to the city or state government. And these are things that obviously need to get done. And it's been some of the most rewarding conversations that I've had since I've been on radio, which will be 8 years on September 11th. And today's no different. We're visiting with Melanie Talia, president and CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation. Melanie, welcome to the show.
Sure. Good morning, Newell. Thanks for having us. How are you today?
Doing well. Doing well. Can't complain. Melanie, if you don't mind, I really want to jump into the Teneo report relative to the French Quarter. I think it's appropriate, especially as a result of yesterday's happening in New York City, where these random acts looking for places that are kind of high profile. As it turns out, this was directed, it looks as though, to the NFL, but you never know. And, you know, this harkens back to that tragic New Year's Eve night here in the French Quarter.
Absolutely, Noel. You know, and to echo something you just said, that there are organizations working hard to fund and finance what city government can't or won't. And the police foundation certainly fits that definition. Immediately on the heels of the January 1 attack, we engaged the services of Teneo, a world-renowned risk advisory firm. They came in, they did an assessment of the city, you know, primarily the French Quarter, but not only the French Quarter. They stayed through Super Bowl, they stayed through Mardi Gras. They made some recommendations. And here we are almost 8 months later without really seeing any progress from the administration on any of those recommendations.
So what do we attribute that to? I mean, is there no one that's been assigned to this task? I mean, obviously everyone went to the mic. Everyone said this was of utmost importance. Everyone said this was critical, the type of city that we are, you know, and what we have at risk and what we could possibly lose. This is very disturbing news, to say the least.
It absolutely, Noel. Yeah, I think we all expected a decision to come from the mayor's office, and then that didn't happen. And we expected some action to come from the city council, and that didn't happen. And as we moved along, it is an election year, so there's lots going on with that. But at the end of the day, I think that what we can say is, effectively, there has been a decision to not shut down the French Quarter just through inaction. Just through inaction. And now, you know, not only did we have 14 innocent lives lost on January 1, just 2 weeks ago, we had a New Orleans police officer in the hospital with a head injury, and we had a sheriff's deputy also injured because somebody's doing burnouts on an open street right there at, I think, Bourbon and Conti. Something's got to be done. We can't keep dilly-dallying. And I know the city wants to do a traffic study. Before long, it's going to be 2027.
Yeah, this is not where I thought this was going. I'm going to be quite honest with you, Melanie. I'm kind of at a loss for words. I mean, because everybody went to the mic. Everybody. No one missed that opportunity.
Look, I would have never guessed that we'd have two vendors cleaning up the French Quarter at the same time. So, the fact that this has not gone anywhere is, it's unfortunate. It just really, really is unfortunate. Not only have we not made a decision on shutting down the quarter, whether it's full pedestrian, partial pedestrian, one block of Bourbon, cross streets, not only have we not made those decisions, but I haven't even heard conversations anymore about equipment. Where's the conversations about the bollards, right? We're coming into budget season. We're going to need RFPs. We're going to need monies dedicated. We need to know what equipment that we need, and we want it to be safe. Obviously, public safety is really our number one concern. But we understand there are businesses and there are residents in the French Quarter, and those people need to be considered. They need their livelihoods. They need to be able to enjoy their homes. And there has, and obviously, we have a very historic area of not only New Orleans, but of the entire United States. So whatever equipment we want, not only do we want it to be top-notch public safety, but we also want it to be aesthetically appropriate for our environment.
So do we know whether or not they're deploying the bollards or not?
Yes. Bollards are at the bollards are at times going up and coming down and being moved around. Are they the crash tested bollards that we'd like to see? I don't believe so. No, not yet. And you know, we also have to consider emergency vehicles getting in and out of the quarter as we consider the bollard deployment.
Right. So, to the best of your knowledge, then we don't have an overall strategic plan for the dissemination or implementation of bollards, even just at that level, separate and apart from all the other observations made in Teneo, the Teneo report.
Absolutely. I think a lot of folks look to the superintendent and her command staff to make some of these decisions. And there really is only so much they can do, because we know that if they were to block a street and interfere with someone's ability to get to and from their residence, or interfere with a business's ability to entertain its guests, or even interfere with a parking lot and the ability to go to and from a parking lot, we know the mayor's phone is going to be ringing, and we know the city council members' phones will be ringing. So this decision needs to be made, and it needs to be made by the city administration, taking into consideration everyone's needs. And look, we get it. There's probably no perfect plan, at least not from the get-go, and it's not going to be an easy plan. But we got to start somewhere. And then once we have that initial plan, we can start to alter and make changes. And just think of it as phase one, because once we're successful with Bourbon Street, we might consider expanding it to other parts of the quarter and maybe even other parts of the city.
Yeah, I mean, I don't...
I hear the frustration, Noel. I share it.
I'm flabbergasted. I mean, a lot of time and effort went into this. Obviously, a lot of folks articulated concern, right? And made commitments that this would be resolved. It doesn't seem like anyone's taken one step towards doing that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it doesn't sound good.
Yeah, sometimes the wheels of justice move slow, Newell. We all know that sometimes they come to a complete screeching halt. And that's something that we've got to change. We've got to move forward with this. The Teneo report obviously made several recommendations, including the better communication between agencies and recommending a fusion center. And we had heard the superintendent promote that idea. So we do hope going forward that not only is the possible pedestrianization of Bourbon Street considered from the Teneo report, but that their other recommendations are seriously considered and implemented.
Melanie, is this one of those situations kind of like, and maybe it's your organization, maybe it's not, I don't know. But, I mean, you know, it wasn't until we got the private sector involved in moving things along for the Taylor Swift concert as well as the Super Bowl and able to coordinate a bunch of activities and, you know, the whole nine yards of drawn upon the strengths of that people have of their experiences in the private sector and coordination and logistics and things of that nature to get it done. Is that what it's going to take? I mean, if so, let us start advocating for that right now. I mean, we got too much to lose.
Newell, I do think that's what it's going to take. The Police Foundation has continued to beat the drum on the Teneo report and the recommendations therefrom, whether it's equipment, pedestrianization. Let's get started. Let's do something. We can't just not act. And obviously, we've also heard from FQMD. They, too, have chimed in, and they've said the same thing. It's not going to be a perfect plan, and it's not going to be an easy plan. But let's get a plan in place, and let's start working it until it is a good plan.
I mean, it's really interesting. you know, I've never served in a leadership role in the city of New Orleans as an elected official or otherwise, but I recognize right away that the French Quarter is the jewel. I mean, why, you know, why is it not the focus? I mean, you know, that's what draw.
Absolutely.
I mean, we survive on sales tax dollars, and we're wedded to the tourism industry, and how we cannot or how we let 8 months go by is beyond me, because we're coming into the convention season, right? We're coming into all of those great things that we do and have here in this city in very short order.
And, absolutely. Wow. You know, one of the best things we had going for us was that earlier this year was having Mardi Gras declared a Tier 1 rating, right? This is the special event assessment rating, which brought equipment and supplies to the city during our holiday period that we otherwise would not have had. We were very, very fortunate to have had that happen. So not only are we coming up on a heavy convention season, we'll have Bayou Classic coming in November, obviously the holidays. New Orleans is a top 10 destination for New Year's Eve. And before you know it, it'll be Sugar Bowl again. And we will literally be 365 days from a terrorist attack, from 14 lives lost, and having for all practical purposes, made no real change to public safety in the French Quarter to protect the jewel of the state of Louisiana.
One of the central themes of the Teneo report was the appropriate utilization of technology. Has there been any movement along those lines in the French Quarter?
Well, as we have seen, the movement along those lines has been in the private sector, as you just mentioned, with the cameras that are around the French Quarter, privately owned cameras on private businesses, and everyone has their right to do that. And those cameras have facial recognition on them. Now, the city council has revisited, and it has been on their council agenda again and again and again. I think it's coming up now in August, an amendment to the technology ordinance that took so much away from our law enforcement officers a few years ago. They are considering giving some of those tools back, including their ability to use facial recognition to identify the location of wanted subjects, but we are not quite there yet. But that is a recommendation of the Teneo report, that the technology in the quarter and around the city needs to be upgraded, and it needs to include metadata and facial recognition.
Yeah, you know, when you look at the response last evening from the NYPD and their state and federal partners, and the ability that they had to determine a whole lot of things in a very short period of time. I watched the coverage till, I guess, past midnight last night. You know, the mindset has kind of changed in how much information you're going to divulge, how quickly to put the public at ease and everything else. Felt pretty good about, you know, how they handled that. But that's as a result of all the technology they have, the Fusion Center. I don't know if you've been to it. Pretty damn impressive, you know, and they seem to be able to have worked out a lot of these issues. They put on a big New Year's Eve. They block a lot of stuff. I mean, you know,
yeah.
And, you know, it's not a freedom of movement event by any stretch of the imagination. And it is what it is. I mean, but I don't know.
All around us, Newell, all around us, there's facial recognition, and all around us, there are license plate readers, and all around us, there's all this technology that's doing great things for other parishes, other counties, cities, and states. New Orleans seems to be behind the game on this. Hey, look, right next door, our neighbors in Kenner with the Flock system, they've made some incredible arrests lately using Flock. I mean, the technology is out there. It can and it should be used constitutionally. And I think that we have seen that in other places. And it is time for us to let the New Orleans Police Department be the police of the city of New Orleans. Let's give them what they need to keep the community safe. And 100% should safeguards be in place? Yes, we believe that. And we know the superintendent believes that. With the proper safeguards, let's let the police be the police. If someone's wanted and they're standing on the corner of Bourbon and Canal, by all means, let's pick them up.
So where do we go from here? I mean, I don't want to just let this ball drop. I mean, I intend to start making phone calls because this doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, it just really doesn't. I mean, look, I know a lot of the strategic things they've done from manpower deployment changed. That I know has changed because I've seen the cost of it. But that's what begs of the utilization and deployment of technology is to reduce that human capital cost that's out there. And we now find ourselves in a $70 million deficit where before they told us money was no object. I mean, we were just bathing in money, right? I mean, and now we aren't. So we got to get smart about what we're going to do, but doing nothing is not being smart about it.
Agreed. We're in the 21st century. This is modern day policing. And in a city that hosts millions and millions of visitors every year, in addition to keeping our own residents safe, when we've got 900 or so police officers, give or take, we need all the tools of public safety that we can engage. And that includes technology, that includes facial recognition. Again, going back to funding and financing, what the city is not able to. The Police Foundation, we've been supporting the digital forensics unit for several years now, exponentially growing their output by as much as 70%, growing their output, and also supporting the drone unit, not only the implementation of the drones, but also having provided some hardware to the drone unit to enhance that unit. Now, on a larger scale, Newell, let's get the Fusion Center up and running. I mean, as you said, the Fusion Center in Baton Rouge is incredible. That is a gorgeous fishbowl, and we need a Fusion Center in New Orleans. As big, major metropolitan city as we are, with millions, 15, 17, 20 million tourists every year, and more to come in the perfect world, we've got to have a Fusion Center.
Well, before we run out of time, this is why we need to support your Stakeout for Justice luncheon, which is scheduled for September 4th. Tell us about it real quick.
September 4th at the Marriott, noontime luncheon. We will be joined by Lieutenant Billy Nungesser. Looking forward to hear what Lieutenant's got to say about the French Quarter and public safety in New Orleans. And it's an opportunity for the community to show how grateful they are for not only the New Orleans Police Department, but also for the Louisiana State Police, that we are the only organization in town who is dedicated to supporting our local and our state police officers with training and equipment and supplies. We'd love for the community to come out and say, thank you, NOPD. Thank you, LSP. We appreciate you.
Melanie Taglia, President and CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation. Thank you so much for your time today, and have a great week.
Thank you, Newell. You too, and to your listeners as well.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We reviewed an article in the Wall Street Journal the other day, and it's entitled, A Tiny Company is Vouching for Risky Insurers in Hurricane Country. And in the article, it points out that insurers are using the differences between raters, and there's four of them for the most part, Demotech, AM Best, S&P Global, and Kroll. And Demotech is the subject of this article, where the insurers are using the differences between the raters to their advantage, shopping around to get the best score. One may give this company A a C+. Another one may give them an A. And they are marketed as A-rated insurance companies. But what is the truth? And has this led to, you know, the climate that we have with homeowners insurance in Louisiana, Florida, so many other states that Demotech is involved in? And is it misleading? Ben Albright, CEO of the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of Louisiana Independent Agents Service Corporation, joins us. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Noel.
Ben, it was an interesting article, but from my view, very troubling as to, you know, what is the matrix? What are the analytics? What is the standard that we're judging these companies by financially? And it seems as though Demotech is more willing in catastrophe-prone geography to give higher ratings, which kind of runs contrary to that, because if there's a storm and you get hit and you have losses, how do you pay them off?
Sure, and I understand the concern, and certainly I share some of that, but I do think it's important to see some context around this. You know, the framing of the article was kind of around, as you described rightly, that the companies were shopping around between these different raters to find the one that suits them best, which there may be a little bit of that going on, but frankly, what a lot of it is that the larger rating companies, AM Best and S&P, being the two big ones, are they're unwilling to rate small companies. They will only give a rating to larger companies with more experience that they can have more data on and those kinds of things. And unfortunately, there are not enough of those doing business in Louisiana to support the entirety of the market. And so if you ask me, would I prefer an AM Best A-rated company to a Demotech A-rated company? Absolutely. I would take the AM Best rating. I think that is more, it says more about the company's financial statement than a Demotech company's rating does. But we don't have the luxury of doing that, because then there would be not enough insurance in the state to cover all of the people. And so it's a little bit, unfortunately, of a beggars can't be choosers situation, and we must rely on some Demotech companies.
Well, I get that, but wouldn't there be an interest on the part of the state to set a baseline as to the criteria, the matrix, the analytics that are used of the finances of these, a lot of which are startup companies? They're paying themselves pretty nice salaries. You know, they're beginning their operations. They have a nice office, maybe a building or two, but they don't have any reserves. And they don't have any money.
So how do you get an A?
I mean, you know,
yeah.
It's like,
Certainly I would say that the most damning part to me of that article was the fact that some number of companies were not downgraded from an A until a week in some cases before they went insolvent. And obviously that's not good. And I think even Demotech would probably tell you that that was a failure on their part and that they need to do better. And I would certainly agree with that. I would say that the Department of Insurance, by statute, does have some minimum requirements that insurers have to have. They have to have at least $10 million in assets, and they have to have their reinsurance treaty stress test. And let's be honest, $10 million in assets for a homeowner's insurer is not much money. So it's not like that can, you know, give you great comfort, but it does mean that the ownership at least has some significant skin in the game. The reinsurance stress testing is really the key component here, because in any of these smaller homeowners companies, and that's what the Demotech companies are, they tend to be the smaller ones. As I said before, AM Best rates the really big ones, and that's where you get a really good comfortable situation, but we don't have enough of those. So these smaller ones are always going to rely very heavily on reinsurance. They have less assets, which can be okay if you have a really good reinsurance treaty. Unfortunately, buying reinsurance is a little bit more of an art than a science. It's not like buying insurance on your house where you just buy up to the limit, because the losses are more complicated than that. Some, you know, you may buy up to a certain amount for the first storm, and then up to a certain amount for a second storm, and then up to a certain amount for a third storm, or third and further. And, you know, so maybe you bought enough for the first two storms, but you were unlucky and had three storms in 1 year, and suddenly you're left bare. And unfortunately, that is a lot of what happened in Laura, Delta, Zeta, Ida. As you know, we had several storms in 1 year, which really tested reinsurance, and that's when these requirements for the department to start stress testing reinsurance treaties for these small companies came into being, because we found that they were deficient and we didn't necessarily know that in advance.
So Ben, let me put you on the spot for a second, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So $10 million in assets. Let's say you pass the reinsurance stress test with flying colors. These criteria set forth by the state, is that an A?
So it may be, but frankly, anyone that is operating in the state must have those things. And there are some people that operate in the state that do not have an A. There are people that have lower scores than that. as the article said, not that many. It tends to be that if a company is going to get below an A, they choose not to take the rating, right? They choose to just go unrated and, you know, not have a lower grade.
Because it would seem to me typically what the state sets out is a minimum standard.
Correct.
They're not putting out their A standards, right? Because if they were putting out A standards, AM Best and S&P Global would probably rate them.
Sure. Well, and so, I guess that's true to some degree, but
you see the conflict that I'm having, I mean,
I do, and the state
knows this is going on. I mean, you know, and we're using it as a marketing tool, and we're giving people a false sense of security by saying, you know, and they really believe I'm with an A-rated company until there are claims. I mean, you know, the one thing that always drove me crazy is I think it's, and I don't know whether or not we're testing this, I doubt that we are, is concentration. So how many homeowners policies do I have in a small geographic area, right?
Right.
And I'm really betting on storm tracks at that point. Because if the storm goes into that area and I'm heavily concentrated there, I am screwed.
Well, but that's exactly what the reinsurance stress testing is. That's what I mean by stress testing. They essentially run computer models that say, based off of the policies that you have in force, if this happened, if exactly Hurricane Ida were to hit today, what would happen to your reinsurance and your capital on hand if, you know, a bigger storm were to hit? If, you know, God forbid Hurricane Katrina were to happen again today, what would happen to your reinsurance? And look, the business of insurance is taking on risk. And these smaller companies, there's always going to be more of a risk of insolvency. And so that's why I say I would prefer to have, you know, the big names. You know, Travelers Insurance is a top five writer of homeowners insurance in most states in the country. They do not do business here because it's too risky. And so because big companies like that refuse to do business here because of the high levels of risk, we have to rely on these smaller companies. And so the reinsurance stress testing basically says, if these certain things happen, this is how the reinsurance would respond and they would be okay. But there is always going to be a point where a reinsurance treaty would not be sufficient, and you can't expect them to, you know, they can't buy infinite reinsurance. They have to pay for the amount that they buy. So nobody buys reinsurance to have four Hurricane Katrinas hit in 1 year. And obviously that's, you know, a hyperbolic example, but there is always some level where there is going to be a risk of insolvency with these smaller companies that you don't have with the larger companies. So long term, I would love to attract these big companies back to Louisiana, but that's going to take a significant amount of reform to our systems because they just refuse to play in a risky environment with difficult litigation that we have seen after storm after storm after storm.
So in the analysts that are used, one of the other things that was interesting to me is that, like, Demotech has about 450 companies that they're rating. They have five analysts, right? Which is about 90 companies per analyst. AM Best is about 26 analysts per company that they have. You know, I mean, there's so many other criteria that you look at. I mean, Demotech, the entire company, has 18 employees. And yet they are rating the riskiest insurance companies out there. It all sounds like a farce to me. I mean, it just, there's not a single piece of criteria by which one would judge by. If you were an investor and you were going to invest, you know, this is a company you wouldn't invest in because they are an outlier to the industry in many respects. Is that an unfair characterization?
I guess I would argue with you a little bit on that. I would say that they are an outlier. You're right there in that they don't service the kind of mainstream business. In insurance parlance, I would compare this a little bit to admitted companies versus surplus lines companies. You know, a surplus company, they handle the riskiest business. They do not operate similarly to an admitted company. but it is a legitimate business model. It's just they're working on more difficult stuff, more risk. There's more risk involved in the investment for the investor, but you also have potentially a greater, you know, return on the investment because you're taking on more risk. You have the potential for more return. And that's kind of the space that Demotech operates in, so to speak, that they are not, you know, your kind of Main Street insurance companies that are in, you know, 47 states in the country that they write most of the business. They tend to look at these coastal states specifically that are served by a different market. And it's still important that we rate those. And I think that Demotech serves an important role in that case. Certainly, I would like them to do better. I think that it's unacceptable for you to have an A-rated company that then goes bankrupt, you know, 7 days later. And I hope that they have implemented some procedures to improve on that. But I do think that they're a legitimate company that serves a legitimate and important role in our insurance ecosystem.
Yeah, because part of the problem with that is 3 days of them going before they go insolvent, you have agents marketing that insurance company and actually signing policies, right?
Right.
And I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a real transparency that's going on here, because the regulators have known for months that this company's gone insolvent. And they're relying on statements of the owners saying that they're going to recapitalize the company. Demotech admittedly says they rely on the principals of the company that tell them that they have additional capital and they're going to recapitalize the company. And that's why they leave the A rating on the company. But they don't get any evidence of saying. They don't have a letter of intent. They don't have anything.
Yeah, and they said that that's what they did, and that's why they still rated it an A in the week before. That's the kind of thing that I'm saying. I hope and I believe that they have improved those processes.
But Ben, not to be argumentative. You've been around a long time. That is not a best business practice from any perspective of any business model. If you are a rater, and you are selling to the public your analysis of a company, right? Do you rely on the principles of the company saying, oh, we're recapitalizing, and you don't ask for any other evidence?
And I think that that's a question of timing to some extent, Noel, because that was in the weeks after the storm. They were saying, we're going to recapitalize and we're going to get this. So just wait and we'll show you this. So don't downgrade us right now. And you can make an argument that they waited too long. And I think certainly I would make that argument. And I think Demotech probably would admit that at this point. But realistically, you know, they have a difficult job. They don't get the transparency that the regulator does. And the regulator is not allowed to communicate that because you don't want to run on the bank. Same as the FDIC. If they start to see that a bank is in trouble, they're not going to start to say, hey, this bank is in trouble, because then people start pulling their funds. It works exactly the same with an insurance company. If they're on the bubble, the Department of Insurance is not going to say these guys are on the bubble, because then people start canceling their policies and that will make the company insolvent. And so it's exactly the same principle. And so it is a difficult job. And I agree with you that they did a poor job in some of those instances. But I do think it's also worth noting in that article, it shows that it's something like 1.6% of their ratings they got wrong, essentially. Now, I think it should be better than that, but that's not a horrible average. It's not like they've been wrong on more than 50% of their chances, and you know, they're just throwing darts at the board and hoping that.
Yeah, but that's not a fair characterization, because they never did an analysis. Wall Street Journal, that is, never did an analysis of when they were right and when they were wrong in the aftermath of a storm. Because the stress level that you're actually testing is their ability to pay claims, not whether, you know, they didn't look at and they didn't take out of the sphere those insurance companies that got hit with no catastrophic losses in a particular year. You know, when when you recalculate that sphere of, you know, testing their ability to pay claims when they were, you know, a storm that was hitting their insureds and their ability to pay these claims, their ability to hire adjusters, their ability to respond to the insureds, that wasn't included in there. And that's where the rubber meets the road. I mean, you read these horror stories that are, you know, people are
a little bit there, Noel.
They're broke, these insureds. I mean, their lives are forever ruined. There's no way for them to come out. And, you know, the handoff to the guarantee fund, and it's not only a problem in this state, it's a problem in every state, is sloppy at best. I mean,
and
really
that's
sloppy.
Absolutely true. The guarantee fund, it's a difficult position for them to be put in because they have to take over these policies with no notice, and, you know, they're trying to get into the data files of a now defunct company. It's absolutely a disaster, and it should not happen, and we need to do everything we can to prevent it. My only point is that what the Demotech rating does and that 1.6% number is responsive to the claims that they have had. So they're showing all of the companies that they rate against the actual exposure that they have shown, and they've been wrong 1.6% of the time. So that is real-world testing. That is them showing we gave these ratings, and 1.6% of the time we were wrong, and one of the highly rated companies went under. So I don't know that you can necessarily argue that, you know, in a lot of cases. Now, I can argue that 1.6 is still too many because their job is to predict that accurately. And if you're not downgrading them until the week before, absolutely that's a problem and it needs to be better. But they're still a company that is important in the ecosystem. You still need them to be giving ratings to these smaller companies because we just don't have any other options in the state. And we have to have some measure of, is this a financially sound company? It can always be better, and we need to hold them accountable and continue moving them forward. But we also need them to continue operating because it is an important part of the ecosystem.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because if I grabbed any analyst off of Wall Street, they don't invest in this company.
Well, it's a privately held company, absolutely.
I understand, but if it wasn't, they wouldn't. Because none of the safeguards are in place. When you're making this representation, you know, out there, and there's no liability to them. I mean, you know, that's the other interesting thing here. You know, they literally have no liability for their rating because this is very subjective in nature. There's no objective criteria by which we do this by. And meanwhile, families are destroyed. I mean, just literally destroyed. And we wonder, you know, why we find ourselves in a debacle we find ourselves in. I mean, not that this is the only cause. I'm not trying to imply that, but this is one of many issues. Something needs to be done. I mean, somebody suggested, who rates the rater? I don't know.
Yeah, and you know, absolutely. Like I said,
you know, I know those publicly held companies like AM Best and the others, there's somebody rating them, right?
There's not actually. They're judged in the same way that Demotech is judged, that when they get it, if they get it wrong too often, then people lose faith in them and they'll go to one of their competitors. And that's,
sure,
that's the fundamental point here, is that, you know, Demotech is operating exactly the same way that AM Best is and S&P is and all of those things. They've got their criteria and they evaluate on it. They're doing it on riskier business. So I would argue that it makes sense that they would be wrong more often. But to your point, they have to be right most of the time, and they have to be responsive quickly. And I agree that they failed at that in some of these storms. But I do think it's a little bit disingenuous to say that they're, you know, an investor wouldn't invest in them, or that they're running bad business practice or any of those things, because I think that they are legitimately trying to do the best they can, but they're filling a market need that is very, very difficult to fill.
Yeah.
And they failed, and they need to do better. But, it, you know, they're doing a pretty good job that on a very difficult risk. So, you know, I think they're a legitimate business. I think that they are filling a legitimate need, and I think that they are trying to do their best. But you're absolutely right that there needs to be constant oversight. We need to be looking at them, and we need to be making sure that they are, you know, evaluating regularly and objectively in some way and being responsive to the public, because my agents and their policyholders absolutely do rely on these ratings. And frankly, in a state like Louisiana, more than we wish they would, because we just don't have the capacity from the big players that are less likely to go insolvent.
Absolutely. And that's fair enough. Ben, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Always appreciate your approach, your honesty to these subject matters. Thank you so much and have a great week.
Thank you.
That's Ben Albright, CEO, Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of Louisiana. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line.